Well, good evening. We're going to pick up where we left off this morning and continue looking at discipleship. And what is it Jesus asks us to do when he says, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. And one of the things I want you to start to begin to pick up on as we look at discipleship. Did I have my mic on or did I? Okay. Sometimes I yell so loud, I don't know if I'm actually using the mic. What I want you to catch on is that discipleship has a lot to do with us allowing our mindset to be changed. And so often we're looking for, give me a list of things to do, and Jesus is interested in changing the way we think. You know, one of the first things that the early disciples had to come to grips with was that Jesus would call them instead of the people you would normally call. That Jesus has a different mindset. And what I want you to catch as we start defining and refining our understanding of discipleship is discipleship is more of a how than a what. All right? It's not so much that we're going to go do discipleship, but that as we go do the things we do, we're going to disciple through it. And so if you can sort of lock this thought in your head that anything we do for Christ, we can disciple through. And so that's why I said earlier, you know, you ask, are we doing discipleship? And you say, well, we do Sunday school and we do preaching and we do... You may or may not be discipling through those things. I can't say categorically, oh, Sunday school does not count as discipleship. I can say that it can. But it comes to us embracing the mindset of Christ and the way in which he did ministry. And it was a unique way. And so the first thing we saw is that one of the unique aspects of the way Jesus did ministry is that he was willing to take folks that we wouldn't normally take. And I think that challenges us in our own ministries. As we serve Christ, are you willing to take people with you that you normally wouldn't want to take with you? That it's not a you have to be good enough to join him in ministry. So if it's not a you have to be good enough, what is sort of the key issue when we come to discipleship? If you're not saying you earn it by merit, what do I need to be to make this work? Nope.
Is it on?
It is. It's blinking. All right. All right. I'll tell you when to move. We're not going to move through a lot of slides fast. So, one of the things we start coming to do is, well, how do you decide whether someone's going to come in? If it's not going to be, you need to earn it. I mean, that's normally when we do ministry, that's the whole mentality, right? If you want to go on a missions trip, you fill out an application, and most of that application is, how good are you? I mean, I filled out references for different ones of you. Rate this kid on 1 to 5 on anger management, 1 to 5 on emotional stability, 1 to 5 on, you know, and you go through, because we want to know, are you good enough? And what we're finding with Jesus is he called people who would have flunked all those. So we want to go back and look at the calling of the disciples and go, well, how does Jesus decide who gets to follow him? And so I'm going to read you the passages we read this morning, and I'm going to add one more to it, and we're going to look at three spots in Matthew. So again, just to refresh your memory, in chapter 4, when Jesus calls the fishermen, Matthew chapter 4, verse 18, while he was walking by the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon, who was called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. And he said to them, follow me, and I will make you fishers of men. Immediately they left their nets and followed him. And going from there, he saw two other brothers, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, in the boat with Zebedee, their father, mending their nets, and he called them. And immediately they left the boat and their father and followed him. Now I'm going to add one that we had skipped earlier. If you move up to chapter 8, we're basically just jumping over the Sermon on the Mount, so these events really aren't that far apart in the narrative of Matthew. There's just a really cool big sermon in the middle. But in chapter 8, verse 18, now Jesus saw a great crowd around him, and he gave orders to go over to the other side. And a scribe came up to him and said, teacher, I will follow you wherever you go. And Jesus said to him, foxes have holes, and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. Another of the disciples said to him, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. And Jesus said to him, follow me, and leave the dead to bury their own dead. And when he got into the boat, his disciples followed him. All right? These are some men that it actually doesn't say whether they did or didn't follow him. And we'll come back to that. And then again, the calling of Matthew in chapter 9, verse 9. As Jesus passed on from there, he saw a man called Matthew sitting at the tax booth, and he said to him, "Follow me." And he rose and followed him. And as Jesus reclined at the table in the house, behold, many tax collectors and sinners came and were reclining with Jesus and his disciples. And I'm going to leave, we'll just stop there for tonight. There's one other account that we could have brought in, and just for keeping things sort of short, there's another account where someone was interested in following Jesus, and it's a rich young man, and they have an interesting conversation. You'll find, if you're familiar with that story, it fits with everything we're going to observe from these texts. And so that's why I felt like to save us some space. But when we look at this, he calls people from all walks. Anybody's welcome. Jesus doesn't force them. But there is this question of who's going to follow. And I'm going to make two observations that will sort of shape our talk tonight. And these could be sort of a Captain Obvious statement about Jesus' invitation to follow. If you want to move to the next slide, these are the two things. All right, this is real straightforward. Those who don't leave don't follow. That makes perfect sense. All right, but as obvious as it is, we need to point that out, and we're going to chew on that a little bit. Those who follow cannot remain inactive. All right, those who don't leave don't follow. Those who follow cannot remain inactive. And I want you to kind of latch on to those two ideas, because as we start talking about what it means to follow Jesus, a lot of times, as obvious as those statements are, we act like we don't want them to be true. Yes, Jesus, I'll follow you, but I do totally plan on staying put where I am. You can try that. It's not physically possible to work, but you can try it. Or the other side is, okay, Jesus, I'll follow you, but I don't really want to do anything. Well, then what did you mean when you said, okay, I'll follow? I mean, it's nonsense, and yet it's what we do. It's, and what I want you to catch is we start going in tonight into the cost of discipleship. Cost of discipleship is not Jesus being a bully and picking on you. It's just the logical outcome of if you actually follow him. You can't follow him without leaving stuff. And so when Jesus says these are things you have to leave, the truth is he's just being honest. He's being upfront and going, if you follow me, I just want you to know this is what happens when you follow. And so you either are willing to embrace it or you're not. And so he's not being a bully. He's not just making, you know, abstract standards to push them or something. He's actually making them understand what the commitment they're making is. So if they make it, they know what they're getting into. I can relate to that because as a ministry leader, you know, I often have kids come to me, hey, we want to join your ministry. They have no idea what they're asking for. They don't know what that commitment means. And so before I let them join, if I want to follow Jesus' model, I need to be up front with the commitment, up front with the cost. And that's one of the things we see is, while Jesus didn't say you have to be good enough, he is at the very outset going, but you do need to know what you're committing to. You do need to be willing to embrace the cost. So rather than saying those who join the discipleship of Jesus need to be good enough, they need to be willing. And so commitment becomes the gateway to discipleship. Commitment's the gateway, not moral superiority. And so you'll find when people want to follow Jesus, he always catches them in a situation where they are aware of the cost. Because they always have to leave something to follow him. And so they're immediately aware of the cost from day one. I think we so often want to do this backwards in our ministries. We know ministry is difficult and costly and will cost you of your time and convenience and might even have relational, you know, expenses. But we don't want to say that because that might scare people away. So when we need someone to help out in church, we try and sell it, you know. We talk about all of the perks and how great it's going to be, and it's really not that bad, and you should totally do this because it's awesome. I mean, imagine if we tried to recruit for your Arizona mission trip, and I got up there and said, by the way, you know, you may not sleep well while we're there, and the weather's it's not that great. If you don't handle heat well, this is going to be horrible for you. So come. That's not how we do it, but that is how Jesus does it. Jesus is up front. He's not hiding the difficulty. And while that might be a difficult starting point, it does mean that those who follow come ready to stick with him. They're not going to be two steps out the door going, Jesus, wait a minute. And so I want to look at this, and we're going to start, and you can move me to the next slide, just talking about what did they have to leave, because this was really what the cost was. What did they have to leave? And you got these three stories, all right, with the fisherman and the tax collector, did you notice that Jesus came to them at work? This is where Jesus would be totally socially unacceptable in our culture. If I'm going to lead a mission trip and I show up where your kid works and tell them, hey, come, we're going to go on the mission trip now, just leave mid-shift. Most of their parents would be very upset with me. They would say, that's completely inappropriate, Tim. You can't do that. But that's basically what Jesus did. He shows up while they're working. I mean, for the sons of Zebedee, they leave their dad in the boat cleaning a net. See, Dad, we're going to follow Jesus. It was immediately inconvenient. I mean, in Matthew's case, and this one really sends my imagination in so many different directions. He says he's at the tax booth. He's sitting there at a table with money, collecting taxes. And Jesus says, come follow me. And he gets up and he walks off. What about all the money? I mean, he just leaves the booth sitting there. Jesus doesn't say, finish up your day, put your stuff away, give the Romans notice. After 2 weeks, you know, find me where I'm at. When it says that they left their nets and they left the tax collecting booth, I want you to understand that one of the first costs these men ran into is that they might be leaving their livelihood behind. The guarantee that they could support themselves was taken away. A fisherman without a net has no promise of food. A tax collector without his booth and without his Roman guards that sit at the booth and force people to pay has no income and no safety. And so when these guys decided they were willing to follow him right on the spot, they knew up front that there was a cost, that they were stepping out into risky territory where this may jeopardize their future financial stability. They had to be willing to leave that and say, I don't know if following Jesus will necessarily be the most lucrative life choice I make. Jesus' discipleship is not about making you as wealthy as you can be, or as successful in the world's eyes as you can be. It's about making you useful in his kingdom. And I'm not saying that he doesn't use you in careers, because I know he does. But following Jesus isn't always the most cost-effective way of doing a career. Let me give you two examples, a negative and a positive. First, the negative. I bumped into a fella in my area, and some folks said, you really need to meet this guy. He's passionate about discipleship. And since you're passionate about discipleship, you guys just have to meet, have to talk. And so I meet the guy, and we're just really not seeing eye to eye on anything. And I finally just had to be like, tell me about your discipleship. What do you do? And don't hear me wrong. I think what he's doing is good. I just don't think it's discipleship. He said, well, I get youth that are, you know, in bad lifestyle situations, and I help them sort out their career path. And so when he starts talking about what he feels like were a successful discipleship, it's the fact that he's helped some kids become doctors and lawyers. Now, that's success. But I don't know that's discipleship, because the measuring stick that he's using is that he has helped them move into a more successful way of life financially. It wasn't about whether he's helped these men come to understand what it is to live like Jesus or share their faith, have godly character as a lawyer or a doctor. It was just that he was kind of a career coach. And because he took them from a lifestyle that probably did not have a financially stable future into one that did, he's passionate about discipleship. And see, we can say any sort of mentoring is discipleship. Well, no, not really. Jesus had a goal that these people were learning to be plugged into his kingdom and would become like him. And if we're not engaging people's character and seeing them transformed in the likeness of Christ, it's not discipleship, even if they are gaining skills and talents and abilities. It's not just career coaching. But let me give you a different example. When my grandfather got saved and became passionate about being used of Christ, he began to let himself be submitted to Christ and be changed. God did not call him out of his career. My grandfather was a tailor, and ran some dry cleaning businesses. And he did till his retirement. But what happened is he became a man who was sensitive to God's heart and was willing to be flexible. And so there were some rules at his dry cleaning business. Namely, whenever my grandpa would tailor a suit for somebody, he would get done, and then he would say, there, now you look good on the outside, how about the inside? And if the person was willing to talk, he would reach out and pull the curtain shut, and that was a cue to the lady at the front desk that they were to hold all calls and not to disturb him until he came out. And he turned that dry cleaning business into a witnessing hub. It is probably the only place I've seen where you could find tracts for handing out that the stamp on the back was not a church address, but a dry cleaner's. And he would distribute them. And he'd go do visitation at the hospitals and meet with people. If he knew somebody in the hospital, he'd go to visit them and the floor. And that whole floor would be his for the evening. He became a man who let his heart and his character be shaped and conformed, so much so that his entire generation in his family attributes their salvation to him. We went from a group of people who were either nominally religious, you know, attending more out of a traditional mindset, or not religious at all, to being church planners and missionaries, and then just a whole group of folks who raised up godly children and in honest, Bible-believing, gospel-believing homes. And when we went to his funeral, to hear the different family members go, John witnessed to me. It was a testimony of John's life change and his character over the years that brought us to come back to church and seek God for ourselves. It was a man who was willing to say, God, you get my life and you get to do with it what you want. He was not the most successful dry cleaner in the world. I have no idea how good of a tailor he was. But I know his testimony. So much so that his funeral, just his obituary showing up in the newspaper, brought out complete strangers to the funeral who just wanted to show up and say, this man's life was a testimony that led me to Christ. It's not the what, but the how. And what I saw with my grandpa was a man who was very, very intentionally to bring people alongside him. He did it with my dad, because my dad was saved later in life, and grandpa just brought him under his wing, spent years walking alongside him, teaching him what it means to be a Christian. And I saw him do it with me. Anytime we'd go out to visit, it wasn't enough for grandpa to just hang out with his grandchildren. He wanted to know what was going on in our minds and our hearts. He had adapted his way of life to one that makes disciples. He did have to leave things. There were things in his lifestyle, you know, by the time I knew him, were long since left behind. There wasn't always the security and the guarantees. But I give you this example because I don't want you to think my whole pitch is, so everybody, you know, you need to be a missionary on the next boat out of here. If God wants you to, then you better get. But the point is being willing to leave some things and to risk some things if that's what's necessary. And it's always necessary. So they left nets, they left a tax collecting booth. But let's look at these two guys that we don't know if they followed. And I stress this, it doesn't say about the two men who said, Lord, I will follow you, whether they did or did not follow Jesus. It simply doesn't say. Jesus is up front with him about the difficulty of following. And then it says, and when he got onto the boat, his disciples followed him. Here's what I know. If they chose to leave those things, they were disciples, because the only people that got on the boat, Matthew calls, disciples. So he's up front with the cost, and if you're willing to embrace that, then you are a disciple. So what was the issue? And their two scenarios are very interesting. I think the first one's a lot easier. Scribe says, Jesus, I'll follow you. And he says, foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. A scribe was a decent position in Israel's days. This is a man who at least would have a career that is supporting himself, and he may have been familiar with comfort. We don't know whether he would have been familiar with luxury or not. I don't know how challenging of a statement this is, but it does push this idea that you're leaving what's comfortable. You're leaving what is home. No place to lay your head means no home. And see, when we follow Jesus, we become citizens of a heavenly kingdom. We become sojourners in this world. And so even when you're home, you're not home. When you follow Jesus, it is a decision to leave being at home in this world and comfortable in this world to a life that is not comfortable. And you got to decide if you're okay with that. If you're so attached to the comforts of this life that becoming foreign to it and being changed where you actually rub against it and don't fit in here, where you have no home, are you okay with that? Because that's the cost. When you follow Jesus and become like him, you become like him as one who's building a kingdom still to come and a hope that's not here but is out there that we wait for. So when Peter writes about the followers, he says that we are aliens and strangers in this world. That's the way he describes the believers. This became the identity that we related to in the early church. Far too often, I think, we want to be at home. Jesus, you can come, you can use me, but, you know, I'm an American, and I have a way of living that is my way of living. Don't mess with that. Don't change my culture, Jesus. I'm comfortable with doing things certain ways, and if you rock that boat, I'm not comfortable anymore. So, I don't know if you've ever gotten to travel into a different cultural setting. It's uncomfortable to be outside of your normal, to be in a setting where what you do doesn't fit in, and people don't always understand you right because you do things with a different mindset. Jesus is going to do that to you if you follow him. You begin to view the world differently, and people go, what are you doing? Why don't you do that? He should, anyway, if he's actually changing you. And so you got to be willing to leave comforts, leave home. Now, the second one's really interesting, and probably the one I think we can struggle with the most. This man says, Lord, I'll follow you wherever you go. Let me just first bury my father. And he says, follow me and leave the dead to bury their own dead. And it seems like a very harsh statement. And it seems like the request was fairly justifiable. And I would say in their culture, even more justifiable than it is to us. I don't know that any of you guys were planning to actually literally bury your dad. You might have contemplated it in your teen years, but that's different. But in their day, there's a real strong view of the family. In all likelihood, his dad is not dead. And what he's saying is, let me finish my obligations as a son, and then I'll come follow you. Bare minimum is, let me finish my obligations. It may carry with that the idea of, I want to stay so I get my inheritance. Let me get what's mine. In a sense, then I'm going to be more prepared, right? If I wait till I finish my obligations with my dad, I get what's due to me. I come to Jesus with resources. Let me do it in a way that makes sense to our culture, in a way that's going to really fit. But also the sense of, can he leave if he's supposed to be there working for his dad in their trade or on their property? Can he just leave? Would he be willing to go and say, Dad, I want to go follow Jesus, and I'm not going to be working the farm anymore? He says, let me just finish that. Let me not deal with any of the cultural clash that following you has. Let me finish out till they're gone, and then I'll go follow Jesus. So, Jesus, don't make any ripples on cultural expectations of me. So Jesus gets to be second place to expectations. We do this to Jesus. Yes, I want to follow you, but I have to. Have to what? What makes it above Jesus' call? Because anything that you say, I have to do this before I can obey you, Jesus, has become your God. Because it gets to trump his authority. Jesus has to be first place. I'm a Christian first, an American second. I'm a Christian first, and a member of the King family second. And if what Jesus asks me is going to put me in tension with people in my own home, Jesus needs to win that fight. In my own life, following Jesus was difficult. I'm the middle child of seven kids, and my oldest two brothers, at the time that I was jumping into ministry, had both left the faith. One of them very vocally. And so I knew that becoming serious in my faith would always be a frustration for them. And the more Jesus kept taking me in directions that mean I couldn't just be serious in my faith, but I also was going to be spending most of my time doing Christian things and investing in people in a Christian way, that there was going to be antagonism. When I would come back from outreaches, my one brother would be waiting up till I got back. So, what'd you do tonight? Well, that was a waste of time. And just pick it apart, hypercritical. And so you have this like, Lord, can't I wait till I'm 18 and move out? Because doing it now means I have to go, and I share a room with one of them, so like I really, really couldn't get away. This puts a tension between the culture of how a teen should live their life and how I'm going to live mine, and it's going to put me at odds where someone's going, why don't you just go get a better job? Why don't you spend your time on something else? Where's your career advancement in this? And when you've got someone who has got a worldly mindset right next to you, it's intimidating. You may know full well that they're wrong and that their values are wrong and this drives their criticism, but you still really don't want to face it. Because the expectation is there. How do you explain to somebody that what you're doing is a good use of your life when its value is only found in Jesus' value system, not in the world's? I didn't tell both servers, I mentioned in the earlier service, my career path before getting into ministry was I wanted to be an entomologist and study bugs. That's at least a respectable job title. And as I began to change from that, I didn't even know if the ministry would allow me to even get a college degree. Because ministry is just not terribly lucrative. For those of you in ministry, you know what I mean. That I went from having $6,000 in my savings, which was pretty good for a 16-year-old, to having nothing within 2 years because I spent it all just supporting myself because in the early days, there was no support in the ministry and lots of costs. And you know, so financial possibilities, this seemed like a colossal failure of a decision, colossal foolishness. I had no question in my mind that God was leading it. That was evident. I knew Jesus had called me on this particular road. But how do I explain that to my brothers? I don't want to explain that to my brothers. Because there's cultural expectations that I am just completely throwing out the window. And Jesus says, leave the dead to bury their own dead. And that statement forces you to understand he's not being completely literal because I don't know of any possible way that a dead person can bury another dead person. It'd be fun to watch if they can. But and so he's doing a play on words here. He wants us to catch that there's a different kind of dead. There's more than a physical dead. That there is a way of living that is a dead way of living. And that cycle will repeat itself and perpetuate itself. And if you're going to follow Jesus, you need to be done with trying to submit yourself to a dead cultural lifestyle. Let the dead continue their own cycle. There will always be enough people who don't actually have a spiritual life and spiritual values to continue that cycle. But if you're following Jesus, you need to be willing to say, and I step out of that. I'm not going to be in bondage to trying to follow a culture and expectation that has only been perpetuated by people who don't love my Lord and who have made their values in a completely secular, worldly way of value. My life lives on a different standard, and I answer to that different standard. And so they had to leave cultural expectations. And I think what you're going to find is if you follow Jesus, he's going to make you do things that the world's going to go, why did you do that? You could have done that better. My own parents' decisions in the way they handled finances as we got moved out to Pennsylvania because of economic downturns that happened in the Midwest about 25, 27 years ago. You know, there's a lot of folks that would said there was better ways for my dad to handle it that would have involved stiffing people and business dealings that wouldn't have been good character but would have been legal. And to choose to work his way through and honor his commitments was a very difficult thing for our family and put us years of just being really, really tight. And you could have folks going, why do you do it that way? You're a fool. Cultural expectations say don't saddle yourself with those problems if you don't have to. But he lived on a different ethic because it mattered to him that he have a good Christian testimony first. And he trusted that God would take care of us. And he did. So these are some of the things they had to be willing to leave. And Jesus is right up front. They don't take one step following Jesus' disciple until they say, okay, I can face this. I'm willing, Jesus. So let's move to the next slide. So what is this cost? Let's quantify this a little bit. In a sense, it's satisfaction. It's material satisfaction in the sense that you might actually go without a bed. You might be in physical positions that are not satisfying. You know, growing up in a home where the finances were really tight and you eat ramen for lunch every day, for some folks, that would not be very materially or physically satisfying. When you make decisions that don't make you as wealthy as everybody else in a culture like ours that is so wealth-oriented, it's not satisfying. We watch TV, we see the ads, and we go, I want that. Why do I have to live in a way that means I don't ever get to have that? Why do I believe that I should be a good steward of my funds and that if I have excess, it would be better for me to put it to the kingdom use than just splurging myself all the time? And so there's just a whole bunch of things that I know will probably never be a part of my lifestyle. I'm not satisfied. It can be frustrating. And he's challenging him on this. Relational satisfaction. That one hits home. I want people to like me. And following Jesus doesn't mean I get to have everybody like me. Teenagers, this one's big for us. John Piper, speaking at a conference, put it better than I can. He said, I want to come and speak to you and challenge you to let your life count for Christ. He says, the problem is you don't want your life to count for Christ. You just care about whether people like you. And the truth is, if you analyze your thoughts, that's where our mind goes a lot of the time. We're not going, Lord, what do you want to do in this situation? Lord, what do you want to do with me in this relationship? Or how do you want to use me in my church? We're just going, man, I don't think that person likes me. I think they look down on me. This person never respects me. And we're analyzing our actions based on likability rather than whether we're actually contributing to the cause of Christ. And so he's going, there's a cost here. There's a lot of things you could spend your life seeking satisfaction in. And the call of Jesus does not promise in this life that those satisfactions will be met. It doesn't promise them. You may very well go without some of the things you physically want. You may very well go without some of the relationships you really want. Without material possessions that you really want. But for what? And you can bring up the next slide. There is a satisfaction that Jesus does talk about. That those who follow him do not go unrewarded. It's a satisfaction of the soul. Jesus is the one that says, come unto me, all you who are weary and heavy laden. I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for my burden is light. And you will find rest for your soul. See, what we're saying when we follow Jesus is that we're recognizing that all those other satisfactions are temporary, passing things, and there's something that matters more. That in the long run, my relationship with Christ and having peace with him is just more important than whether my clothes are new. That my relationship with Christ is more important than how many friends I have. More important than how much food I get to eat. It's a decision to have a priority that says, yes, Jesus, you will be first. And if you're not saying, I actually want to follow Jesus and make him first, you're not following. And so the types of things he's asking these people to be willing to leave really test whether they're just saying, I want to follow you because it's the right thing to say, or if on a deeper level they're saying, no, Lord, I actually do want to make you the one I'm following. I want to make you my leader. That they understand that there's a need in here that only Jesus can meet. And that a life following him, no matter how difficult and how costly it may be, is the life I was made for. And on the level that matters is the only satisfying road. In my own life, I think what you're going to find is each of these people, it was different. It wasn't a challenge for Matthew to leave nets behind. That wouldn't have been challenging to Matthew. He didn't have any use for nets. Each person that came to Jesus, I think they found that it was a bit different because we're all different people. And I think what you're going to find is the principle is commitment. The application will probably depend where you're at and what God's doing in your life. You know, for me, one of the things that I never expected, God hit me with, I said, okay, Lord, I'll follow. And I began to step out and I saw a lot of the things going on where I was with the youth. We had a lot of issues in the youth programs I was in. A lot of relational issues between guys and gals that were just crippling the youth programs. And I remember going, Lord, how do you want to use me here? And what can I do to be available for your service? And God doesn't always speak very clearly, but sometimes he does, and it's usually not a welcome thing when he does. And it's just like this instant. Give me your teen years. Commit to be single so that I can use you. Is there another option? Most of us guys kind of look forward to getting to that point where mom and dad say, yes, you can start chasing now. And I go, no, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. And we just come through this whole struggle of whether I'd be willing to follow him at all. And he's like, do you really want to fight again? No. Okay. It was a cost. Relational satisfaction. When you go through your teen years committed to be single, most of your friends are married before you even start looking. Most of the folks you probably would have thought about are gone. Those of you guys have gotten out of high school, you realize that weird transition where there are these people you saw every day and then you don't see them at all. And you're going, okay, Lord, that was kind of expensive. What do you want to do with this? I'm not saying God's calling all of you to be single for your teen years. I'm saying that there's costs and it'll be different for each person. The question is, if God says, this is what I ask of you so that you can be available for what I want to do with you, is the answer yes. Because if you don't leave, you can't follow. God put me on a road that kept me single. My first girlfriend, I was 28 when I started dating. So late into the game. But in that season, as you've already heard, God birthed the ministry. I was uniquely available to be focused on it. It would have been completely impossible for me to go and get college as I did in pastoral training while doing ministry, while working full-time, if I tried to have any sort of a healthy relationship with a girl. God knew what he was doing. And what he asked of me was a cost that just was necessary for the road he wanted to put me on. I can see that looking backwards. You don't see that looking forwards. You just feel cost. So you need to trust him that when Christ says, yes, it costs us, now follow, that he does have a plan and he is right and it's necessary and it's good. And I can tell you, it's good. I don't regret one cost that I faced. Let's move to the next slide. So then, okay, we talked about the leaving, but what about the following? And these are the two things we're holding. The cost of discipleship is a commitment to leave and to follow. And he says follow. I think I love that word. I love the fact that the Great Commission is to go, and it's this idea of a journey. It's not just listen, it's not just watch. Our Western culture is very academic in our way of thinking, and so we would have said, come and take my class. I mean that's how we do ministry, right? If you want to be a pastor, you just went through the process. These are the classes you must take, because classes will totally make you into a minister. But we have that mindset, where if I'm going to teach you something, I just give you a lecture and I go my way. I mean, in a sense, that's kind of what we're doing right here, right? I'm going to come teach you discipleship, and then you're all going to just get it and go do it. No, you need to do it to get it. Follow is actually coming alongside. Did it include teaching? Absolutely. Jesus' style of following is so neat, because you'll see him where he goes out and he's doing ministry and they're walking with him. And he'll preach a sermon, and they do listen, and they do watch. And then he pulls aside. Over and over in Matthew's gospel, one of the most repeated things we see in Jesus' way of doing discipleship is him pulling aside with the 12 disciples. I mean, if you just start making observations of what he does, that will be the most repeated aspect of it, is making available that as I minister, I then stop with the one I'm discipling and go, did you understand what happened there? Do you have any questions? Let me explain that. There's entire explanations of parables that only the disciples got. Jesus would preach the parable to the crowd. They'd all go, that was weird. And then he'd go over into a house and then go to the disciples. Now, I want you to understand, when I talk about seed being sown, this is what it means. There was times when he'd be doing miracles and he would stop and he would ask questions specifically so that they could be involved in the decision-making process. So he feeds, you know, a huge multitude, and the next time he sees a multitude, he turns to his disciples and goes, you feed them. And they go, Lord, how will we feed them? And Mark's gospel comments, he did this to test them because he knew what he was going to do. I love to watch that. It's his following. Come participate in ministry. I'm not just going to do my thing. I stop and go, what should happen here? You should be able to figure this out now, because we've done this before. I just want to see if you're catching on. I want to see if you're understanding. And so he stops and he's bringing them in. John's gospel records that Jesus' ministry was baptizing more people than John the Baptist's. And then John makes a side note. But Jesus wasn't baptizing anybody. His disciples were the ones doing the baptizing. And so these people were not just spectators. They were participating. They're out there. Jesus is preaching. People are coming forward. And the disciples are baptizing them. At one point in Jesus' ministry, he sends them out on like a mini missions trip. And they go out and they do everything that they've seen Jesus do. When you read the summary of what he tells them to do, it's everything that Matthew's been summarizing that Jesus has been doing. So they are watching, they are listening, but it's not just those things. It's a hands-on participate with Jesus, dialogue with Jesus. It's high relationship, close proximity. And that's what we sometimes miss in our culture when we're all academic. I mean, you talk to people, which classes they love the most, it's the teachers they got to know who actually reached out to them and invested in them. Because just watching and just listening without the relationship and without the application really doesn't accomplish anything. So in our ministry, one of the things I love to do is I make the kids in my team give Bible studies. And it's not because I don't love to study the Bible and love to share it. I do. You can probably tell that. But I can lecture at them all day. But when I make them prepare a Bible study and they get their hands in the midst of it and I'm sitting next to them going, how's that coming? Do you have any questions? Can I help you get it ready? Light bulbs start going on. They don't give the best studies. But those light bulb moments are worth more than any sermon I could give. When a kid goes, I've been reading this passage and it just really hit me. Do you think it's this? And I'm going, yeah, I think that's exactly what it's talking about. Well, and then there's this. One of my favorite Bible studies in our ministry was probably one of the worst delivered Bible studies I ever heard. This kid was preparing his study, and just for the first time in his life, he got excited about Scripture. And he just He was so excited when he got up to share his study. He was tripping over his words, mumbling and rushing, and he read three whole chapters and was just jumping around. And you could see the poor kids going. But he was just a glory. He's like, and it's kind of like when we, and you had to like stop him and pull it out. What are you trying to say? Yes, that's true. And I know it didn't hit us the same way it hit him. But because he was learning Scripture in a hands-on way where he was participating in the dialogue, he was growing in his understanding, and it blessed me to watch him. Because he learned some things that I know I had told him a dozen times. But now he got it. And that's what we're looking for. Disciples are people who are actually being changed. They're not just hearing it and watching it, but they're embracing it. They're following. And so it's a call to leave. It's a call to follow. And so on the leaving side, there's that question of, are you willing to pay up? If Jesus is an expensive calling, do you want to pay? But then the other side is, are you willing to follow? Because what this means, this is how we disciple. We look for what Jesus is doing and we join him in it. That's the mindset of a disciple. Jesus, what are you doing? What are you doing today? Because that's what I'm doing today. And so if I'm at work and I see Jesus working in somebody's heart, I want to have a conversation with him. Because if Jesus is doing that, I want to join Jesus. If I'm at church and I see Jesus doing something, I want to join Jesus in that. And as he shows me where he's at work and just opens my eyes to that, that's him going, here, we're over here today. Come walk with me. And I want to just stay as close with Jesus as I possibly can. And then trust that that road's going to take me wherever he wants me to go. It's 1,000 small steps of obedience, small steps of staying close to Jesus throughout your day that make the road of discipleship. That's what Jesus calls us to. He didn't give me the big picture. If he had, I wouldn't have been willing to go. He just scared the living daylights out of me. He just gave me little steps, and as I walked and stayed close to him, I found myself in the ministry he'd picked for me. You can move me to the, I think that's, go to the next, yeah. So I want to encourage you, as we start thinking about the how of discipleship, and as we interact with people and want to enter into discipling relationships, I think we need to be honest and upfront about what it's going to cost. Don't hide that from people. Because if you get an honest commitment from somebody, then you can actually have this kind of a relationship. And I think you need to be honest with yourself. Are you willing to embrace that cost? Are you ready to leave? And then are you following? Is that what characterizes your lifestyle? One who's following, looking for where Jesus is at and trying to stay as close to him as you can and learn as you go. That's what we're after. That's the challenge of being disciples. Let me pray for us. Father, it continues to just amaze me that you would want to have us be disciples, that you want us close. That love and that care is humbling, and God, it inspires us to have hearts of worship. I pray that we would not be deterred by the cost, but rather be excited about the opportunity. So give us willing hearts, God, to embrace the cost. And then, God, I pray that you would bless the paths you take us on and that you would multiply your kingdom through each one here. I ask this in your name. Amen.